Next up is Professor Randy Barnett. Professor Barnett is the Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Legal Theory at Georgetown University Law Center. In fall 2011, he was a visiting professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a former prosecutor and a graduate of Harvard Law School. His books include Restoring the Lost Constitution, The Presumption of Liberty in 2005. Professor Barnett argued the medical marijuana case Gonzales v. Reich before the Supreme Court, and he is representing the National Federation of Independent Business in its constitutional challenge to the Affordable Care Act, which is now pending in the Supreme Court. Professor Barnett's topic this morning is Originalist Interpretive Methodology, the distinction between constitutional interpretation and constitutional construction. And you can find it at tab number five. At tab number five, you'll find Professor Barnett's Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy article on this subject. Professor Barnett, thank you so much.
Thanks, Alice, for having me here. I see some familiar faces out there, and it's great to be here. Yeah, I'm going to give a somewhat different talk than the one that's in your binder, so you can use the one in the binder as a review. And my talk takes most of the 30 minutes that I've been allotted, so I'm going to try to go through it quickly with the minimum of introductions and setup, so that there'll at least be some time for questions and answers at the end. The decision in D.C., District of Columbia versus Heller, and McDonald versus City of Chicago were not only landmark victories for gun rights, they were also a victory for the intellectual movement known as originalism. For 20 years, legal activists and scholars have been building a powerful originalist case on behalf of the individual right to keep and bear arms, and rebutting the bogus originalist claims on behalf of the so-called collective right, in one instance actually produced by a scholar whose name was bogus. His name is bogus. Justice Scalia's opinion in Heller was expressly originalist, as was Justice Stevens' dissent. And unlike Justice Alito's plurality opinion in McDonald, which, though originalist in spirit, was ultimately grounded on precedent, Justice Thomas's swing vote concurrence in McDonald was thoroughly originalist. In my remarks this morning, I wanted to talk about what is called the new originalism, so that any of you who may in the future be engaged in originalist scholarship about gun rights or any other topic would have a better sense of what the current state of play is with respect to constitutional interpretation. I'm going to make four points about the new originalism. First, the new originalism is about identifying the original public meaning of the Constitution and not the original framers' intent. Second, those engaged in new originalist scholarship ought to employ a more rigorous methodology than was employed by the old originalists. Third, I want to explain the difference between the activity of constitutional interpretation and the activity of constitutional construction, which is in the title of my talk. And that's important to understanding how the new originalism is more open-ended than the old originalism. And fourth and finally, notwithstanding that it is more open-ended, I want to insist that the new originalism still has bite, it still matters. So first, original public meaning versus original framers' intent. The old originalism purported to interpret the text of the Constitution according to the intentions of its framers. This enterprise was objected to on two grounds, which I, at the time, for one at least, found persuasive. First was practical. There was a big practical difficulty identifying collective intentions of the framers. How do you systematically identify what a diverse group of people thought about any particular issue? As a result of this problem, and because new constitutional cases typically involve factual situations unknown to the framers, this methodology usually entailed a hypothetical and counterfactual inquiry into how the framers would have addressed an issue had they thought of it. Before I was an originalist myself, I called this channeling the framers, as in, oh, framers, would you think that the thermal imaging of a house to detect increased heat generated by marijuana cultivation is a search? The second concern was normative. Why exactly should we, the living here today, be bound by the framers' intentions? I called that at the time the framers as wardens model. We had to do what they said because they somehow had authority over us. But it was at that time more commonly called by other academics the dead hand problem. as in, what justification is there for us to be ruled by the dead hand of the past? For these reasons, I and others declined to become originalists. Then along came the new originalism. Rather than attempt to identify some collective intentions of the framers, the new originalism looked to identify the original public meaning of the words of the text in context. In other words, it is seeking the meaning communicated to the public by the words on the page. This is like the objective or reasonable meaning of a contract at the time of its formation. Such an inquiry looks to three different sources of communicative content of language. First, it looks to the semantic meaning of the words on the page. For example, what was the generally accepted meaning of the word commerce at the time of its enactment? Second, it looks to the publicly available context of those words to resolve problems of ambiguity. For example, when Article 4 empowers the government of the United States to, quote, protect every state against domestic violence, unquote, the publicly available context reveals this to be a reference to riots and not spouse abuse. Publicly available context might also explain why, although the Constitution does not expressly reference slavery, the public would know that the words other persons in the 3/5 clause of Article 1, Section 2 was a reference to slaves. The third thing it looks to is what might be called constitutional implicature, or what the semantic meaning of the text implies in fact. And if you're thinking in contract law terms, this would be like an implied in fact term, something that's not expressed but that's implied. For example, the Ninth Amendment says that the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. As some have noted, this is a rule of construction that expressly enjoins one, and only one, particular constitutional construction. Any claim that because some rights have been enumerated, another unenumerated right may be denied or disparaged. That's really all the Ninth Amendment literally says. Or to put it another way, a right that is not enumerated may not be denied or disparaged on the grounds that other rights are enumerated. That's what it says. And by the way, just as an aside, I think this is exactly what footnote 4 of Carolyn Products actually does. I mean, it violates the literal meaning, the expressed meaning of the Ninth Amendment when it says that some rights get privileged just because they've been enumerated. The Ninth Amendment does not actually expressly state that there are other rights and that these other rights may not be denied or disparaged. It's a rule of construction of the sort I've just described. But I think it's fair to say, and the reason why it tends to be read to mean more than that, is the original meaning of the Ninth Amendment implies more than what it expressly says. In particular, it implies, first, that there are natural rights that are retained by the people, and second, that these rights should not be denied or disparaged. That's what it implies. The rule of construction included in the Constitution, in fact, would make no sense. And its presence in the first 10 amendments would be inexplicable, except on the assumption that there are rights retained by the people that ought not to be denied or disparaged. Taken together, then, these two implied propositions enjoin the denial or disparagement of natural rights, even when such a denial is not being justified on the grounds that other rights are enumerated. So that's what I mean by constitutional implicature. Now, of course, such a meaning, in particular of the Ninth Amendment, could have been communicated expressly rather than by implication. So I just want to talk a little bit about that so you can see the difference between expressed and implied. To see how, consider the following provision that was proposed by Representative Roger Sherman as a member of the House Select Committee, tasked with drafting amendments that became what we now call the Bill of Rights. Here's the beginning and the end of Sherman's Second Amendment. The people have certain natural rights which are retained by them when they enter into society. Of these rights, therefore, they shall not be deprived by the government of the United States. Although Sherman's proposal is not what the Ninth Amendment eventually said, what the Ninth Amendment does say implies to a normal speaker of English both the existence of natural rights that are retained by the people and an injunction against the deprivation of those rights, while making a further point about how not to read the Bill of Rights. In other words, Sherman's proposal is part of the original implied in fact meaning of the Ninth Amendment, or at least so I contend. So the new originalism is, in my view, more practical than the old originalism, insofar as it seeks to establish an empirical fact about the meaning of text at a particular point in time, rather than a counterfactual reconstruction of the collective or group intentions of a particular group of individuals. But this still leaves the normative question. Why should we follow the communicative content of the Constitution at the time of its enactment? New originalists do not give the same answer to this question. So let me offer my own. In other words, the new originalists disagree with each other about how to answer that question. Even if they agree with each other about what we should be doing, they disagree with each other about why. So I'm just going to give you my answer for what it's worth. I start with the proposition that the written Constitution is the law that governs those who govern us. The written Constitution is the law that governs those who govern us. A written Constitution cannot serve this purpose if the very people who are governed by it can themselves, alone or in combination with others, alter the meaning of the constraints imposed upon them any more than each of us can alter the meaning of statutes or regulations imposed upon us without going through the amendment and repeal legislative or administrative processes that produce those statutes. As John Marshall wrote in Marbury versus Madison, the powers of the legislature are defined and limited, and that those limits may not be mistaken or forgotten, the Constitution is written. To what purpose are powers limited? And to what purpose is that limitation committed to writing, if these limits may at any time be passed by those intended to be restrained? Now, you don't have to take John Marshall or my word on it for it. In fact, I wouldn't recommend taking Marshall's word on very much. But you don't have to take John Marshall or my word for it. The Supremacy Clause of the Constitution in Article 6 reads, in part, "This Constitution shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby." For present purposes, of greatest importance is the reference to this Constitution. This is a direct reproach to those, and I would say to those academics, because I can't imagine a non-academic actually holding the following view, who think that the Constitution is a broader concept, which may or may not include the written Constitution. Actually, it's not unusual to think that the Constitution is broader than the written Constitution, but only an academic would think it doesn't even include the written Constitution, right? And there are some who say that. No, the Constitution that is the supreme law of the land is this one, the written one, not a constitution provided by the Supreme Court of the United States. Secondarily, this passage expressly says that, quote, "the judges in every state shall be bound thereby," unquote, which means that the text of the Constitution is the law of the land that binds state judges who, under the original Constitution, were the only lower courts to consider federal question cases unless and until Congress established inferior federal courts. So at first, there were only state court judges. There were state courts and there was the Supreme Court until Congress passed the Judiciary Act. But then Article 4 goes on to say more about who is bound by this Constitution. Quote, "The senators and representatives before mentioned and the members of the several state legislatures and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution." So this Constitution is the law that governs those who govern us. And you don't have to take my word for it. It actually is expressly in the Constitution of the United States, the written one, the one that hasn't been repealed yet. And it cannot serve this purpose if those who are supposed to be governed by it, including federal and state judges, can on their own change the rules that are supposed to apply to them. Indeed, one succinct way to describe the new originalism is the proposition that the expressed and implied public meaning of the words on the page should remain the same until properly changed. The meaning of the text should remain the same until it's properly changed. That's originalism in a one-sentence headline. And the proper way to change this Constitution is provided by Article 5. Judges are not allowed to update the text of the Constitution by changing its meaning that it had at the time of its enactment. Okay, that's my point number one. Let me move more quickly now through my three remaining points. In ascertaining original public meaning, the new originalism ought to be practiced more rigorously than was the old originalism. Historians, for example, were often critical of originalist scholarship for cherry-picking quotes to support their views, say from the Federalist Papers or some other source. So that I say Madison said X and you say Hamilton said Y, now what? Some anti-originalist historians also objected that intentions are just too hard to identify with enough specificity to resolve a current case or controversy, though this has not prevented, apparently, the same non-originalist historians from filing amicus briefs, asserting their own opinions about how the original intentions behind, say, the right to keep and bear arms, or the power to regulate commerce among the several states. So the same our historian critics of originalism are more than happy to tell you what the intention of the framers are, even though the new originalists really sort of no longer make such claims. Establishing the semantic meaning of the words in the text, given the publicly available context, requires, in my view, a survey of the relevant usage. For example, in my article on the original meaning of the Commerce Clause in the University of Chicago Law Review, I surveyed every use of the term commerce in the Philadelphia Convention, the Federalist Papers, and the ratification debates. Then, in a sequel in the Arkansas Law Review, I added a comprehensive survey of 1,500 or more uses of the term commerce in the Pennsylvania Gazette over an 85-year period. The effort here should be to be as systematic and comprehensive as possible with respect to any source that one chooses to use as a source of meaning, and to truthfully and honestly and candidly report deviant as well as predominant usage, so that you should be disclosing where evidence seems to be pointing the other direction. What we are searching for when we do originalist scholarship is an empirical fact. What information would these words on the page have conveyed to a reasonable speaker of English in the relevant audience at the time of its enactment? And different people can disagree about that fact, but that's what we're searching for. In this inquiry, the linguistic usage by opponents, for example, of a measure, as well as proponents of the Constitution, are relevant, as are even, for example, private letters, insofar as private letters reveal meaning. So, for example, I used just a moment ago Roger Sherman's draft of the Bill of Rights, which was only circulated privately among the select committee in the House. It was discovered amongst Madison's papers in 1989. Nobody really knew what it was until they identified it as Sherman's by his handwriting. This was not a publicly available document. And nevertheless, the way he used the word rights, the way he used the word retained, the people, this all says something about how those words, and he connects those up with natural rights. This says something about what those words meant to the people who were communicating with each other at the time, even though it was, you know, secret. Okay, third point, and this is the point that was actually the billing point of this talk, interpretation versus construction. Now, having insisted that the meaning of this Constitution is the publicly available meaning at the time of its enactment, the new originalism is then more modest than the old originalism about the amount of information actually conveyed by the words on the page. Even when broadened to include publicly available context and constitutional implicature, the new originalism takes seriously the distinction between what philosophers of language distinguish between ambiguity and vagueness of language, the ambiguity and vagueness of language. Language is ambiguous when it has more than one sense. When one says, this feather is light, one might be referring to its weight, or one might be referring to its color. The word light has more than one meaning. But unless one is being poetic, one ordinarily does not mean both at the same time. You mean one or the other. In contrast, language is vague insofar as it has a core meaning that is clear, but a penumbral meaning where it may or may not be clear whether or not it applies to a particular object. So a white feather is clearly a light feather, and a black feather is clearly not. But how dark gray a feather must be before we cease calling it light and start calling it dark is just not always clear. The new originalism claims that, except for some special cases, ambiguity can usually be resolved, that is, the choice between different senses, can usually be resolved by reference to textual or historical evidence of context. So arms in the Second Amendment refers to weapons. It does not refer to the limbs to which our hands are attached. The term arms is also ambiguous, could be ambiguous, but it's not in context. We just think it has one meaning. We don't even think about the fact that it actually has another meaning. With respect to vagueness, however, the original meaning of the text, the information conveyed by the original meaning of the text, can simply run out. That is, the words on the page. I mean, there's only so much information in the document, and the information just isn't there as to whether it might or might not apply to some marginal object. So it just doesn't specify whether a particular object is in or out. So for example, whether a particular search is reasonable or a particular punishment is cruel is not something that's answered by the semantic meaning of the words on the page, even when context and implicature is taken into account. When original meaning runs out, constitutional interpretation, strictly speaking, is over. And some new or different non-interpretive activity must supplement the information that is revealed by interpretation. New originalists refer to this activity as constitutional construction. And in fact, historically, if you go back and look at sources about interpretation, these words are not always used consistently, but oftentimes when old authorities are talking about construction, they're not talking about interpretation. They really are talking about some other activity besides that. There's a lot of different ways they used to describe it, and they're not systematic, but construction does tend to be used historically this way. It doesn't really matter what you call it. You can call it both interpretation, and one is strict interpretation, and the other one is not. I mean, whatever it does, that itself doesn't make a difference. As long as we realize that there are two separate activities that we who come to interpret the Constitution are forced to confront. One is, what are the meaning of the words? And the second is, what do you do when the meaning of the words run out? But you still have a case to decide. For present purposes, the important thing to note about constitutional construction is that while the activity of construction might be constrained by the original meaning of the text, the original meaning of the text could provide a boundary within which you can choose constructions and outside of which those constructions are impermissible. The activity of construction is needed precisely when the communicative meaning is not of the text itself is not sufficiently determinant to dictate a unique application. So extra guidance must be supplied by some non-originalist methodology. By adopting the interpretation construction distinction, the new originalism frankly acknowledges that the text of this Constitution does not provide definitive answers to all cases and controversies that come before Congress or the courts. In this sense, the framers and ratifiers of the Constitution locked some things into their text and then delegated other matters to future decision makers by the way they worded their provisions. While the Constitution is the law that governs those who govern us, as we all know, constraining government officials was not its only purpose. The Constitution was enacted also to empower government officials. The vague terms in the text, the Constitution was enacted to create a government that would work, not simply to stop whatever government might happen to be created. It had two purposes. The vague terms in the text empowered legislators and judges to put flesh on the bones of the text, provided that they don't break any of the bones, which is the big problem we have. For example, although the Constitution says nothing about the time, place, and manner regulations of speech, this body of constructed doctrine, judicially constructed doctrine, is an effort to flesh out the contours of the rights of freedom of speech, press, and assembly. Devising doctrine to effectuate what this Constitution says does not violate a judge's oath, it fulfills it. Because the new originalism is a theory of constitutional interpretation, how constitutional construction is to be done is beyond the scope of originalism. It's beyond the scope of originalism. Except to note that the construction is improper if it contradicts or undercuts what this Constitution says. So, as a result, originalists can and do disagree with each other about how extra originalist constitutional construction is to be done. You cannot expect originalists all to agree about this issue, since what holds them together is that they're originalists, not what happens when they're not originalists. This disagreement that how people come out on this subject of how the meaning is to be supplemented is often informed by what a particular person thinks makes a constitution legitimate and binding. So those who rest constitutional legitimacy, for example, on the consent of the governed, might take one approach to construction, while those who, like me, rest constitutional legitimacy on justice or natural rights, the protection of the rights of the people, might take another approach to construction, and then we would have a debate about that. But this open-endedness notwithstanding, the open-endedness entailed by constitutional construction and the problems of ambiguity and vagueness of language notwithstanding, my final point is that the new originalism still has bite. Despite the fact that the original meaning of the text may sometimes, or even often, be underdeterminate as opposed to indeterminate, underdeterminate, this does not entail, as some have claimed, that it is wholly indeterminate. The recent dispute, for example, between living originalist Jack Balkin and myself about the meaning of the word commerce in the Commerce Clause illustrates that it matters a great deal whether the original meaning of commerce was trade or the trade or transportation of persons and things from one place to another, as I believe the evidence shows, or social interaction, as Jack contends. A lot matters. And if you want to see that debate played out, I have a forthcoming piece in the University of Illinois Law Review that's going to criticize Jack's claim that he makes to that effect in the Michigan Law Review and now in his forthcoming book, Living Originalism. And the fact that Jack Balkin and I may disagree, who is now an originalist and I may disagree about the meaning of the word commerce, does not refute the claim that there is, in fact, of the matter as to who is right. And that can be, and this fact of the matter can usually be resolved by evidence. With the new originalism, there is a there. Our interested third parties can read my articles and then read Jack's, and then read my critique of his use and omission of evidence, and then read his reply, and then they can reach their own conclusion about who is right about the meaning of commerce. Of course, the new originalism has developed a lot in the past 10 years and continues to develop further. My goal here was just to give you an overview of the current state of the art and some of the basic concepts and distinctions. Should you ever be drawn into such a debate, it is worth noting, however, that the burden of persuasion does not rest solely on originalists. If you get into debate with somebody, they always want to say, prove to me originalism is the right methodology. And of course, to some degree, we all bear the burden of proof. But it's not solely on us. Non-originalists should be asked to articulate how they think this constitution should be interpreted and why. For example, just why do they think we are stuck with two senators per state, notwithstanding that so much has changed since the founding, including views of democracy and the need for one man, one vote, which two senators per state clearly violates. On their theory of interpretation, why can't judges just update the number of senators that each state gets? To paraphrase what Jeff Foxworthy says about rednecks, when a non-originalist undertakes to answer this question seriously, in the end, he or she just may be a new originalist. Thanks. So how much time do we have?
We have 10 minutes before we get Bob Cottrell. And please, you're all smart, talk.
Yeah.
Professor Barnett,
Clayton, right?
Right, okay. Clayton. I was really pleased with your point about vagueness and delegation. Jefferson and Madison actually write a series of letters back and forth when Madison is beginning to put together the Bill of Rights draft, where it's very clear that they are discussing the idea that, you know, maybe we should put things in very rigid terms, and one of them is saying, well, you know, if we make things too rigid in this Bill of Rights, it will eventually be ignored. And so, you know, there's certainly some argument based on their letters that the things like reasonable concerning searches and seizures does represent an intentional effort to, you know, leave a little bit of room for delegation at a later time. But I find what very interesting concerning the Ninth Amendment is in determining intent, I would say, wouldn't the laws that are actually present at the time in the various states be a pretty good indication of what was intended when they used phrases like freedom of speech and establishment of religion?
Well, I agree that they are evidence of what, but they are only circumstantial evidence. First of all, they're not evidence, direct evidence of semantic meaning. There's a chain of inference you'd have to use to connect what the words on the page mean with this other practice over here passed by some legislature that was in existence before there was a written constitution, et cetera, you know, something like that. So, but yeah, sure, it is relevant evidence. It ought to be taken seriously if you're going to, but it's quite possible, and I think in the case of the 14th Amendment it actually happened, that language is enacted into the text of the Constitution that is inconsistent with not only statutes that are in existence, but even majority preferences. The 14th Amendment was enacted under very special circumstances in which text got into the Constitution, even though there you can make an argument that in terms of public opinion, maybe public opinion would have been against much of the implications, or some of the implications of the 14th Amendment. There are historical reasons why the triumphant Republicans were able to get that text into the Constitution anyway. And the public meaning they got in is the public meaning that got in. But you're absolutely right. That evidence is germane. It just isn't dispositive, as some people seem to think.
I understand. My concern is that there is a rule of interpretation that many state Supreme Courts have taken that when a constitutional provision is reenacted that appears to be in conflict with the existing statute of that state. There is an assumption that if the people went ahead and approved this amendment to the Constitution with an existing statute in place, that the, you know, the legislature didn't repeal that statute, that the two are probably not in conflict.
Well, let me just point out, that is a rule of construction.
Yeah.
And there are many rules of construction.
Right.
That rule of construction is not part of the original meaning of the text. But we need rules. I think it's really important for you to take away from this thing is construction is inevitable. Rules of construction are helpful. They are not the same as the text. And so that's interesting. But let me just say, because I feel like I've touched a sensitive nerve with you, Clayton, and that is that to say that the Ninth Amendment protects natural rights, because I have a feeling some of this is motivated by the actual words of the Ninth Amendment, to say that it protects natural rights is not to mean that that rights are trump. That is, that any right that has anything to do with natural liberty or the liberty that is defined by natural rights is therefore unconstitutional. That's not entailed by the idea that that these rights should not be denied or disparaged. If you, for example, believe that it's perfectly okay to have reasonable time, place, and manner regulations of the enumerated natural right freedom of speech, mm-hmm. then it's also perfectly appropriate to have time, place, and manner regulations of the right of all the other natural rights, including the natural right to self-defense and the right to keep and bear arms. But what it means is that, as far as I'm concerned, to put that the rule of construction that I think is the best rule of construction to put the original meaning into the text is what I call in my book the presumption of liberty, which is you presume you sort of instead of having a presumption of constitutionality in which all this an act of legislature is presumed constitutional unless you can show some reason why it's not, you presume that the acts of individuals are appropriate and protectable unless the legislature can show why they need to restrict them and regulate them, which they usually can if it's a just law. Yes.
I find the contract analogy very compelling in a lot of ways, but the place where you lose me is that when you run out of interpretation or construction, it somehow becomes a normative exercise. I mean, using the same logic, wouldn't we have to apply the decision rules that people think would have applied to the Constitution then, or to a contract then, rather?
It's a really good question. Can I just stop you for a second? Because I think it's not my position that construction is a normative exercise. I have the view that you have to do construction, and how you choose to do construction has to be normatively defended for the same reason that you have to normatively defend how you do interpretation too. So there is a normative argument behind it, but this does not authorize judges or anyone else just to engage in normative reasoning to try to reach their results. So there's a difference between saying you have to have a reason why you favor certain rules of construction and certain approaches to construction, and that the method of construction you're arguing for is judicial employment of normative arguments per se. You see what I mean?
Yes.
Does that answer your question?
The second part of the question is that if you do view this as a contract, and is it viewed more as a contract between the people, the United States people at the time, or the actual delegates that put their signature on it? I understand that, like McCullough, I think, said that it was between the people.
Okay, I like this question because it highlights one of the points I made very quickly in passing, and that is what your views of construction are depend, and actually why you're an originalist in some respects depends on the normative reason, depends on whether you have a consent of the governed view and or whether you have my view of justice based or rights back view. So I actually don't view the Constitution as a contract. Other people do. You have to direct that question you ask to anyone who does view the Constitution as a contract, as what I would do. I would ask that question of them. I view the ultimate normative justification of the Constitution against a background in which those who are empowered with coercion, with the power of coercion that Joyce was talking about, have to be constrained with the end of protecting the rights of the people. And so the rights of the people become the ultimate normative barrier, and it's the rights of the people then and the rights of the people now. And those rights of the people, in my view, haven't changed. It's a very good question, but not of me. When I analogize I'm a contracts professor too, so the only reason when I go to contract theory to explain what I'm doing is because I'm talking about interpreting a writing. And a contract is a writing, and we have ways of interpreting it, and the Constitution is also a writing, and some of these things that contracts and constitutions have in common. But I'm well known for the consent theory of contracts. I think contracts are based on consent, unlike what your contracts professors taught you. Whereas I think the Constitution is not really based on consent. Yes?
I was curious if there was a conflict within your theory in that you base the legitimacy of the Constitution on its ability to protect rights, that fundamentally that's its purpose, and if it doesn't do that effectively, it's illegitimate.
It has other purposes as well, which, you know.
Of course, but that's really what,
right.
If that's lost, then the legitimacy of the Constitution.
Right.
Your guiding principle for construction, as I understood it from the book, was that construction should maximize protection of rights in line with that legitimacy.
Well, I wouldn't use the word maximize, so I'm not sure what math, I mean.
Or protect, that to the extent that construction is being engaged in, it ought to.
Yes, I would say rules of construction ought to be chosen with the end of protecting rights as opposed to not, yes.
But it seemed to me that given that there will be disagreement on the issue of what rights are, you will either have a lot of, you'll have a problem at one end, one of the other end, you'll either have a lot of people who will not view the Constitution as legitimate, because we'll just have disagreements as to whether it's protecting the right rights. Or, on the other end, we all agree as to what rights, you know, basically had, whether the Constitution protected some basic rights. When it came to construction, you could end up having judges or legislators claiming that construction authorized protection of rights that others don't think are rights, and that would then undermine the legitimacy of the Constitution.
Okay, so I mean, it's a good question. It's a little difficult. It's such a good question. It's a little hard to answer succinctly. Let me begin by saying that the existence of disagreement doesn't entail very much of anything, because no matter what your theory of legitimacy is, there can be disagreements about the application of that theory. So, for example, let's say you do view the Constitution as a contract based on consent. Then you start to have to ask, whose consent? How do you manifest consent? What do they consent to? There may be real disagreement about consent. That, by the way, does not mean that the consent argument is wrong. It only means there's disagreement about it. So you can still be right in your general approach, and people can still disagree about how that actually applies. And the same thing is true with rights. So that's one point I would make. Another point I would make is that what I actually defend in the book acknowledges the fact that it's probably not a good idea for judges or legislators, for that matter. I think legislators are probably less qualified to opine on rights than judges are, but it doesn't matter. It's not a good idea for any of them to try to do rights theory. We don't want them to try to be Rawls or Nozick. And look, Rawls and Nozick disagree with each other, right? So, and they were pretty smart dudes. So we don't. And that may not be a good idea. That's why the presumption of liberty says, look, forget about rights, or don't forget about rights. Look at justification. What's the justification of this legislation? You know, once you've established that there's a right to keep and bear arms, fine, you've established that. I mean, it's basically liberty. Now, when the government says we need to restrict this, ask them why. And do they have a good reason? And then ask them, does the reason make sense in light of the other things they're doing? So if you want to look at an example of where I think this methodology is done properly, it's in the Williamson v. Lee optical case, but not in the Supreme Court case, in which Justice Douglas says, as long as the legislature has a hypothetical reason, if there's a reason they might have had, is the lower court opinion, where they actually looked at the statute and said, well, where's the health and safety rationale? This statute's justified on the grounds of health and safety. Does that make any sense? Does it make any sense that a technician in an ophthalmologist's office can use a lensometer to refit a lens, but a clerk, but somebody in lens crafters cannot use a lensometer? Is there any health or safety rationale for that? Or really, is it a matter of rent seeking on the part of ophthalmologists, which is what that statute really was about? So that's an inquiry that gets you away from having to figure out what rights are, and push the onus on the government to tell us what justifications there are for it, with the assumption that they will oftentimes be able to do that. This is not an insuperable burden. This is actually a reasonable burden, but it's a burden they have to sustain. They don't get a pass. They don't get to, we don't presume everything they do is okay. They have to tell us why. Are we at the end?
We're at the end. Thank you so
well,
very much.
Well, thanks very much.